Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you think reindeer only fly in Santa stories, think again. In northeast Siberia, in the coldest inhabited country on Earth, in the shaman stories of the Evenyi people, reindeer fly all the time. At 96 below zero, over impassable terrain, over hundreds of miles in endless night and endless day, they move like the wind, and the Evenyi ride them, bond with them, dress in their skins, find soulmates and a different plane of time and space in their midst. The Soviets almost destroyed them, but not quite. Now an intrepid British anthropologist tells their story for the first time. Up next on Point, a winter's tale of the reindeer people and soul voyaging in Siberia. Joining me now from Cambridge, England, is anthropologist and author Piers Vitebsky. He is head of social science at the Scott Polar Research Institute at the University of Cambridge. Piers was the first Westerner since the Russian Revolution to live long-term with this indigenous people of the Russian Arctic. His new book is The Reindeer People, Living with Animals and Spirits in Siberia. Piers Vitebsky, thank you very much for being with us.
Very nice to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you. What a magical book, a magical subject with some hard history right in the middle of it. There's so much we have to learn here, but I wish you'd just begin with introducing us to the reindeer. I don't think we can understand these people without understanding the animal they've bonded with. Tell us something about the Siberian reindeer and its cousins.
The reindeer is a phenomenal animal. Incidentally, it's the same animal as you call caribou in North America. Mm-hmm. Only in North America, it was never domesticated. In Europe and Asia, it was domesticated, and the domesticated one is called reindeer. It's phenomenally well adapted to cold. It has a kind of fur, which is not only very deep, but the hollow, each hair of the fur is hollow, so it holds extra heat. So, as far as I know, it's the only animal which, when it dies in the cold, instead of freezing right through, the body actually ferments inside the fur.
The insulation is stronger than the cold, even here where the temperatures can go to 96 below zero.
Absolutely.
You describe, Piers, the reindeer's history, kind of a remarkable one, as the last ice age receded. Reindeer being as far south as Bordeaux and Paris and all over Europe of today, Julius Caesar seeing reindeer and describing them in his notes.
Yes, when he went to visit the wild tribes of Germany. And it seems that the reindeer have been rolled back consistently from the south, partly by climate warming since the Ice Age, but also by the expansion of agriculture.
In the Arctic?
So now it survives only in areas where there isn't serious agriculture,
and there
among hunters and herders.
Like this area in northeast Siberia, in the Arctic, you say the age of the reindeer is not over. Give us a sense of the reindeer population today and where it is, particularly the one you're looking at here.
There are probably about 5 million reindeer in the world, maybe half of them wild, half domestic. And most of the domestic reindeer are in Russia. We're used to hearing about the reindeer in Lapland, but actually that's quite a small proportion of them. So the north of Russia, the Russian Arctic, is a huge area, and it has 20 or 30 different ethnic groups, and many of those live by reindeer.
In the late 1980s, as an anthropologist, you found yourself in the midst of this remarkable nomadic culture flourishing alongside in kind of a bond with the reindeer. I wish you'd do a bit of a reading from The Reindeer People. It's an unbelievable book, describing the first time you came face-to-face with reindeer in this way-off-the-beaten-path setting.
Well, yes, that was in 1988. It had taken me two years from the beginning of perestroika to negotiate even to reach Siberia. And then it took me further negotiation to get out of the city to the village, and then finally from the village to one of these nomadic camps.
Can
so
you read
here's
for
the
us?
Reading.
Yeah.
Mm. Yes, certainly. As I reached out to touch one of them, I felt I was face to face with a creature of considerable presence. Its fur was chestnut brown, shading whiter where it thickened around the neck. Its coat was so deep that I could run my fingers through it and hardly feel the solidity of the body beneath. But for all its depth, the fur was neat rather than shaggy, with a rich smoky smell that was to become a constant part of my life. Most compelling were the eyes, which were huge, soulful, and capable of engaging one with an intense gaze. This animal, if not eaten first by humans or wolves, or killed by a wound, virus, or parasite, would live for 12 to 15 years. Its nose was covered with a tough, leathery skin, which could be thrust into cold snow when grazing. Within this hard nose, I would later learn, lay nostrils so sensitive that they could detect not merely a human hunter upwind, but the species of a plant hidden beneath the snow, or the location of a mushroom growing 100 yards away. I held out some salt on the palm of my hand, and the reindeer responded with a lick of its long, raspy tongue.
Here we are, Piers Vitebsky, on his first visit to the land of the Iveni people. Here we've got millions of reindeer, many fewer Iveni, and they ran into a hell of an era in the Soviet era that tried them to the outer bounds of their tolerance. But before we look at that, talk to us about the traditional relationship of this people and these animals, how it was shaped, how deep it goes, went.
Well, the reindeer has huge powers of migration, and in fact they have to migrate in order to keep up with the changes of the vegetation. So as the vegetation starts dying off in the autumn, in the fall, the reindeer will migrate downhill or further south to keep up with the last of the vegetation. Then during the winter they graze on lichen, which is something that doesn't ever disappear beneath the snow. And then in the spring, as the green vegetation comes out again, they'll migrate northwards or uphill, following the retreat of the ice and snow. So you could say that each year they're repeating the advance and retreat of the ice ages as they were enacted over thousands of years.
Over many hundreds of miles.
Yes. Some of their trajectories can be up to 1,000 miles in a year, back and forth, in a herd. So they migrate in huge herds. They have a strong bunching and herding instinct, and they travel these huge distances.
And long ago, humans hunted them, and then there came a moment where it went from hunting to a kind of coexistence. When? How?
It's not known. This is one of the great mysteries of prehistory. The hunting pattern is still followed in native North America, with the large caribou herds on the Canada-Alaska border. And some of that goes on in Siberia as well. But they did something else, which was never done in North America, which is they learned how to domesticate reindeer. And we don't know how this was done, because it's a feat that can't be repeated today. Nobody can succeed in domesticating a wild reindeer today. It seems to have happened in South Siberia, on the border of Mongolia, 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. And the evidence comes from archaeology, from rock carvings, which are very hard to date, of course.
But no one knows how it was done. You say, here's the insoluble mystery, yet it happened. We'll talk about how that may have happened, but what did that domestication mean of these animals and the human relationship with them?
It's probably the only animal that has ever been domesticated in order to ride on it, in order to hunt its wild cousins. So it was probably not domesticated for meat, but as a means of transport. And actually that allowed human mobility throughout the whole north of Asia, the area we now call Siberia. And much of that territory is impassable to this day by any other means, except helicopter, of course. So that meant that humans could migrate. Some of these families embarked and still do embark on migrations that can take generations.
There's a very strong shamanistic tradition here. Even in the West, we have stories of magic around reindeer. Reindeers in flight, of course, everybody knows it, from Christmas time, and Santa stories in the North Pole. But is it that mobility that's at the heart of that application of magic to the reindeer, that it was magical how far, how fast these animals and humans on their backs could travel?
That's how I understand it.
And there are several kinds of evidence which point to this. There are prehistoric stones in South Siberia, in Mongolia, dating from 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, which show running or leaping reindeer. But what is extraordinary about these reindeer is that their antlers have grown phenomenally. They have huge exaggerated antlers which look like wings. And the posture of the reindeer themselves looks as though they're flying through the air. And the tips of many of these antlers actually end with miniature birds. And sometimes the antlers actually hold the disk of the sun. So it seems pretty clear that we've got imagery here of reindeer flying up through the sky towards the sun.
And an animal and a relationship that you say gave the humans in this world, gives the humans in this realm, even a different understanding of time and space themselves.
Yes, yes. And I should add, on that landscape, without being on a reindeer, it's almost impossible. You stagger and you clamber over these huge jagged rocks and through these deep swamps. So the reindeer's own kind of mobility, if we capture that and use it for ourselves, it gives us this feeling almost of flying. And certainly when you're on a sledge skimming across a frozen lake in winter at an extraordinary speed, you really do begin to feel as though you're about to take off.
Piers Witebski, I think that idea of living in complete intimacy with another species, another creature, is tough for people to get their minds around. Can you describe, before the Soviet gate came crashing down, and we'll talk about that, but at the apex of this people's intimacy with this animal, what did that intimacy look like day to day?
Much of it is still what you can see today because it's a necessity given the climatic conditions. For example, in the winter, for 6 months of the winter, you must wear an outer coat made of reindeer fur because no other fur will keep you alive. So that means they walk around looking like reindeer and they even smell like reindeer. And I've noticed that when you wear a reindeer fur coat, the herd allows you to move between them much more readily without any disturbance, whereas if you wear some other kind of clothing, they're more cautious. So when you see a person riding on a reindeer, the effect is extraordinary. It's like a centaur with antlers.
The human torso, the reindeer beneath, but they don't ride just any reindeer. I mean, there's domestication and then there's very close bonding here. You write about how the Iveni bond with particular reindeer from the herd to be those that they ride.
Yes, you could call it a kind of elite inner core, if you like. So there's the mass herd and a group of maybe six men and their associated women and children might be looking after 2,000 reindeer. And of those, a couple of hundred might have been selected to be trained for riding and for pulling sledges, and females for coming to be milked.
These are castrated males, you write, castrated male reindeer, which also become a kind of spiritual mate or doppelganger of the people who ride them.
Some of them do that. They have a special kind of consecrated reindeer called a kujai, and each person has their own kujai, and this is exactly like an animal double because your fortunes and your fates are linked to it. So this reindeer is like an insurance, a life insurance policy. So if it dies, you know that it has stood in the way for you. It has offered itself as a substitute for you and taken a blow which would otherwise have harmed you. And then, of course, you have to get another one. It's like renewing your insurance. But this reindeer is one that you look after specially. Small children are shown their kujai. They're given it to herd, to feed, to stroke and look after. So it really is like a kind of exterior projection of your own soul.
And traditionally, within this culture, the position of the shaman, the sort of holy man, I guess, if it's only men, you tell us, but was very high, was central. What was the role of the shaman?
Okay, first I should say that the shaman, the word comes from the language of these people itself. And we now use it for people from all sorts of other tribes.
All around the planet, right?
Yes, yes. And yes, they can be women as much as men. Although there's quite a lot of male imagery to it, because one of the things that the shaman does in a hunting society, it's not only healing, which is what we tend to think of in the West, but it's helping with hunting. So one of the things the shaman would do as their soul flew around was to see where the herds of wild animals were. Their soul would fly around, they'd spot the animals, and they would come back and report to the hunters.
You say that pretty casually, their soul flying around. What do you mean exactly by that?
Well, this is obviously a very difficult concept for us, and we have to take it as we find it. They tell us that they go in, we see them going into trance, and they say that while they're in trance, they have this experience of flying up to different levels of the cosmos, or going down to an underworld, and encountering spirits. They negotiate with the spirits to produce some kind of outcome that the humans on the ground need, and then they come back, and that's the moment when they come out of trance and tell us what they've been experiencing.
I was struck throughout this book by your openness to the spiritual side of this culture's life, its relationship with the reindeer. Your specialty as a social anthropologist is in religion, psychology, poetics of small-scale societies. How do you understand what's going on at that spiritual level?
I suppose I live on several levels at once, as perhaps most of us do anyway, so that especially when you're in that world with those people, of course, you start to think like them and to feel like them and even to dream like them. So it's as close as you're ever able to get to becoming like them. Then, of course, you leave, you come back to your own world, a city, students, cars, and you become not exactly a different kind of person, but a different aspect of the person you are.
When you're in that world, and for the better part of the last 20 years, you've been studying them, been living and traveling with them, is that soul flight, is that kind of engagement with realms of life that seem really off limits to us, do you see it as real is a funny word, but as an anthropologist, how exactly do you look at it? Are you participating with it? Are you kind of doing the Carlos Castaneda thing with Siberians?
Well, Carlos Castaneda perhaps tells us more about California than about the New Mexico Indians. I think you do start living that way, and you do start thinking and feeling it, because one thing, for example, the landscape is extremely dangerous, and a lot of their concerns and anxieties about spirits are to do with avoiding danger. And there are a lot of deaths, there are a lot of accidents. And I've certainly found I've become more anxious and more superstitious about this sort of thing since I started living on that landscape. So I do take all the precautions they take. I don't look back at a grave when I leave it. I take care to feed the fire with the first mouthful of meat and vodka before I eat or drink myself. I try to remember the dream that I get the first night in a new campsite, because that predicts how you're going to live at that site and whether the spirit of the place accepts your visit. So yes, I do become really very like that.
What's the rhythm of the nomadic life when they're out away from encampments with these large herds of reindeer? How often do they move? How do they move? How do they live? How do they set up camp?
The whole movement of humans has to follow the movement of the animals, which is dictated by the vegetation and the animals' feeding needs. So in winter, they don't move very far. So far north, it's dark almost 24 hours a day, and the animals eat just enough to keep alive. But as the summer begins, they start to grow very fast, and they start to migrate very fast. So then you have to pull up your tent and move every 2 or 3 days, right through until the autumn. So that could be from May until September. So in the course of a summer like that, you might move tent 20 or 30 times. Then in the autumn and winter, you tend to be in the same place for maybe a month at a time.
There's the traditional rhythm. The Russian
Yes.
Revolution came, the Soviet Union came, and with that, a huge disruption to the traditional way of life. What happened when the Soviets and the revolution came on the scene?
It took several years for the Soviet regime to establish itself in these far-flung places. The Civil War continued for a long time. But when they finally took it over, they realized they had a practical and ideological problem on their hands, which was nomads. And by their reckoning, nomads were very primitive, and they had to be modernized and civilized. So they established villages for them. These were villages of wooden huts, like Russian villages. Mm. And in these villages, they established schools, dispensaries, all the trappings of bureaucracy and administration. And they thought they were doing these people a favour. But because it was imposed from above, of course, there were various prices to be paid. And one of the other things they did was they collectivised all the reindeer, which meant if you and I own a reindeer, these were taken from us and put into a collective herd, which belongs to the entire community or the state. We may end up still herding the same reindeer, but they're no longer our animals. We're doing so as employees of the state. So our whole relationship to the reindeer has changed. And the other thing that the villagers did was, because of the schools and the dispensaries and the need for bookkeepers and school teachers and so on, they took the women and the children off the land into the village. And that left the men out on the landscape looking after the animals, because the animals had to keep moving. So over a couple of generations, it created a demographic crisis, which you have today, which is the men and women live very separate lives, and they find it hard to marry and hard to hold a family together.
You write that the reindeer herds reached their highest number under that Soviet system. Then in the 80s, it all began to fall apart. The Aveni, at some level, reaching out to the rest of the world when markets went away, when a system went away, at another level, turning back on their own traditions. What's the balance there today between sort of being adrift in a semi-globalized economy up there and, on the other hand, going back to the ways of their ancestors?
It's a very difficult tension because it's not a planned one. What was planned under the Soviet regime was a massive infrastructural support of helicopters that would land right next to your tent, bringing veterinary supplies. They'd pick you up and rush you off to hospital in an emergency. I remember when one could even radio for a helicopter to come because you'd run out of tea or sugar. And all of this would be paid for out of some fantasy budget one didn't even need to know about. Mm. Well, from the early 90s, all that disappeared, of course. But people's way of life and their mentality is still dependent on these inputs, which they're not getting. So some people are thrown back to living on the land because they're capable of it. They know how to hunt, they know how to survive on the land, and they like it. But a lot of others, especially young people who've been brought up in boarding schools with more urban values, simply don't know how to live like this without this support. So there's a high level of despair, alcoholism, suicide among these people.
Do you think that the traditional lifestyle will survive, or is it itself at risk of vanishing?
Something will survive, but I don't know how much we should call it traditional, because if people's mentality and their values and their awareness is different, they're no longer doing it in the same way. For example, these people are extremely well-read. They listen to the radio, they know about politics, they know about literature.
You write about one of them naming a particularly randy reindeer, Bill Clinton.
Yes, they have a great sense of humour. And I think their sense of humour and their sense of irony is one of their strongest assets in coping with changes in the world.
Mr. Vitebsky, take us as close as you can to understanding that part of what you describe here is that there are other ways of perceiving life and the planet, and the Aveni are onto it. What about that texture of time and space? Can you take us closer to their perception of it?
Yes, of course. I suppose one thing is what we were talking about before, that you actually have to pull up your tent every few days and move. So that means the sense of a permanent base that we have has really never arisen in this society, except for the people who have settled down in the village that the Russians offered them.
On the one hand, that sounds mundane. On the other, if you really imagine having no sense of rootedness or living in a constant sense of flux or motion, that must be a very different relationship with the space around you.
Well, what I noticed is how meticulously the inside of the tent is arranged so that it's always exactly the same. Wherever you are, everything is in the same place in the inside of the tent. It's only what's outside the tent flap that differs.
So the bubble in that way travels with them every time they set the tent up.
Yes, yes. It's a bit like traveling in a space capsule and docking on various planets. But then if we think of that in religious terms, If you think of the kind of religions we're used to, with a church or a temple or a mosque, these are permanent buildings, and as you get closer and closer to them and further to the interior, mm-hmm. you're going into zones of greater and greater holiness. Mm-hmm. So in a church, for example, you process down the aisle and you finally reach the altar, which mm-hmm. is the holiest focal point. Well, for the Eveni, there is no such point on their landscape that is more sacred than any other. But what happens instead is each place where you pitch your tent becomes the focal point of sacredness just for the few days that you're there. So you light your fire in the middle of the tent. You feed the spirit of the fire with vodka and meat. And by doing that, you're also making a pact with the spirit of the place. And they sometimes even say, "Spirit of the place, will you please draw back your feet a little bit to make a bit of space for us to pitch our tent?"
And what about on the time front? I spent a fair amount of time north of the Arctic Circle on the Alaskan side, of course, where it can be all light or all dark. That certainly takes away the rhythm we're accustomed to, another kind of floating through continuous dark or continuous light.
There is that, and of course, in the summer lightness, you can be out of doors and the children are playing all night.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine made a joke. He said, "I really like living this far north," he said, "in the summer, because you can get drunk and go to bed, and then you wake up in the middle of the night and look at your watch and think, oh, it's time for lunch."
It's whatever time you want it to be.
Yes. But also, I was going to say something that it took me a long time to work out was the way they interpret dreams. They're very concerned with dreams. They talk about them a lot and they interpret them. And especially when an event happens, they look back and think, aha, this was predicted in a dream, even if I didn't realize it at the time. And very often they say the fulfillment happens exactly a year later after the dream. And it took me a long time to make the connection, which is, of course, a year later is the moment when you come back to exactly the same spot on your nomadic cycle. So it's as if the place where you have the dream is also like a portal to the possibility of that dream's fulfillment.
And that
it's a
very
kind
much
of
in the same cycle
into the future.
And on the same cycle of the reindeer that they know, which is, as you point out, year after year after year, make essentially their same rounds across these vast areas.
That's right. The reindeer can make small variations, and occasionally they change their routes quite drastically. That's in response to, say, a change in the vegetation or a change in the ice cover or something like that. But on the whole, reindeer routes can be stable for generations.
Mr. Vitebsky, I wish you'd give us another reading. I think it might take us even closer here. There's a moment where you're out in the middle of, I'm tempted to say nowhere, but you remind us that everywhere is somewhere on their route, but you're with Vladimir Nikolaevich. Late at night, can you read something from that for us?
Yes, of course. This is one night. Well, of course, night falls at about 2 p.m, because it's December. And this old man, this extraordinarily capable and competent old man, has taken me out on a long hunt lasting a couple of weeks. Just the two of us. Late that night, I stood outside looking at the moon, which was shining with an extraordinary blue light over a crust of snow which was so vast that it seemed beyond comprehension. We were camped on a river bank near some massive crags of layered shale, each horizontal contour etched in sharp lines of black and white. By the yellow light of a candle, Vladimir Nikolaevich was bending, cutting something, fixing something, his shadow projected onto the translucent membrane that encased the glowing bubble of warmth that was our home. By now, the electricity generator in the distant village would have been turned off. The other hunters around us would be asleep, their tents and huts 30 miles apart behind winding rivers, the embers fading in their stoves. An aviator or a shaman could fly around these mountains all night without seeing another light. At any moment, this landscape could snuff out a clumsy, hairless human crawling across its rough surface. I suddenly understood the feeding of the fire in a new way. It was an act of acknowledgement of the flame's concentrated intensity, but also an act of support for its puniness. There was not another tiny island of heat in this ocean of -60°, except in the metabolisms of the mammals that we tracked, for the hairs sprouting densely out of their skins so that they could later contain the warmth of human bodies. The depth of silence was beyond anything I had ever known, made all the sharper by the occasional snorting and scrunching of our reindeer on a darkened slope nearby, each one named, trained, and bound to us by a loyalty that was ancient but could be easily lost.
Anthropologist Piers Witebski reading from The Reindeer People. We hear a lot about exotic plants in the rainforest that ought to be preserved for themselves and for the value they may have to humanity down the road. What about these people in this unique corner, the Aveni? What do we most need, or what do we most need to honor from this people for them and for all of humanity?
Well, it's interesting you phrase it in that way, of course, because what is needed for them isn't necessarily the same as what is needed for us.
But if they're extinguished, we all lose.
I think that's true, because I think this is the great thing that anthropology has a duty to do, which is just to tell the world how many different ways of living and existing and thinking there may be. And these people have certain kinds of insights. And if those insights were lost, certainly humanity would be the poorer for it. What they might need for themselves, of course, is something that they're struggling to work out and express for themselves. And I've noticed big differences between the people who are used to living out on the land and the people who are used to living in the village. And each one finds their own location interesting and the other location boring. So it's quite extraordinary. You can hear people, nomads, saying, oh, I couldn't live in the village, it's so boring, there's nothing to do except watch telly and get drunk. Mm. And then you hear especially younger people in the village saying, oh, I couldn't live out in a tent, it's so cold and there's nothing to do there except chase reindeer all day.
They are on two sides of that veil of perception. Did you ever take on a reindeer double, Piers Witebski, in all your years there?
Oh, yes, yes, and my children had them as well.
And their names?
The children's or the reindeers?
Well, the reindeers.
The reindeers, those didn't have names. Not all reindeer do.
But they live as your kind of cosmic reindeer counterpart. What happens when you're away?
Well, when I'm away, I have to trust friends to look after them. And occasionally I get a message saying, oh, your Kujai died last week, you know, shall we do you another one?
It's a
bit like getting a letter from your insurance company saying, do you want to renew your policy?
Well, we hope you've always got one, and we hope that they do too. And we're very grateful to you for bringing us such a picture of a culture on a far frontier. Piers Witebski, it's been wonderful having you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
British anthropologist Piers Witebski. His new book is The Reindeer People, Living with Animals and Spirits in Siberia. You can see a gallery of photos from the book at our website, On Point Radio. And if you get the book, check out the tattoos from this people historically. They are quite remarkable. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Oh, Allah, say you pow, Joe, may go away.